Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, welcome to The Legacy Tapes. I'm Rebecca Atkinson-Lord, and this is a series of conversations with artistic directors about how you can leave something lasting in an ephemeral medium. And I'm here at ARC in Stockton with the brilliant and wonderful Annabelle Turpin. Hello, Annabelle.
Hello.
So, Annabelle, we've just been chatting for 20 minutes before we started recording. And I asked you to tell me a little bit about how you got here. So can you tell me professionally, rather than through public transport, how you made it to be the artistic director and chief exec at ARC in Stockton?
I suspect I'm probably quite unusual in that I've only ever worked in art centres. Mm-hmm. And I'm very passionate about art centres as organisations and as venues. I left university, I had lots of events management experience from work I did as a student. I had a love of theatre from my school days that was never going to be a kind of professional option for me because I am not a performer. So I kind of thought that was just something that I did on the side that I went to watch. And then I got a job at Warwick Arts Centre. Mm-hmm. as an assistant house manager. I learned my trade from, you know, yeah, doing that kind of front of house stuff.
Wrangling.
Which is a really lovely, lovely way to learn actually about audiences and art forms. And it was an amazing place to be because you had everything from international orchestras through to, you know, Nigel Charnock in the studio, you know, doing really cutting edge work. So it was an amazing way to just learn about performance in all its forms. And visual art as well, there was a gallery, but I'm not really big on visual art, so. And then I was there for 5 years, and then I went to work in another art centre in Maidenhead, which was a brand new venue. I was there about a year before it opened as deputy director and operations manager. So I kind of took what I'd learnt at Warwick and applied it to somewhere completely new where I got to shape how things worked operationally. Started doing a little bit of programming, eventually became director there, and then moved to ARC 8 years ago.
And thinking back 8 years, what... Because I feel like this city has changed a lot in those 8 years. Like, when you arrived, what did you want? What were your crusades? What did you want it to be?
I'm going to just go back and talk a little bit about being in Maidenhead.
Okay.
I loved being in Maidenhead. The venue was amazing. It was a beautiful building, really well conceived. We got to do some amazing things there. But it was in Maidenhead, which is a very affluent, educated area where the people have a sense of entitlement. There is no doubt that they are entitled to the best cultural entertainment going.
Right.
And it would be great if it was on their doorstep, but frankly, if it wasn't, they've got the means to go elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And obviously there are people in here that can't do that, but that's the kind of majority. Mm. And I got a bit sick of that, actually, because I felt like it was quite restrictive artistically. They knew what they wanted the best. They did take some risks, admittedly, but, you know, it was kind of limited. So I came here where there was a challenge in the organisation because the organisation was failing, and that was something I wanted that challenge. But there's a much bigger challenge of just the kind of the social need, in a sense. Stockton is an incredibly deprived area. There are pockets of affluence, so there's some quite big differences, and I think difference is interesting in itself. And there's not really many other people doing it. So it felt like it was a huge opportunity. And it sounds really cheesy to say I wanted to make a difference, but I felt like Stockton was somewhere where I could work in an organisation that made a difference. Whereas in Maidenhead, I loved the organisation and people had a good time, but it didn't feel like it was really making the impact that I wanted it to make.
That makes sense, because if you're spoiled for cultural provision, then any one experience isn't necessarily going to leave you changed.
No.
But if it's the one thing you see in yeah. your school life or in a year,
yeah.
you'll treasure it in a different way.
Yeah. The impact is massive, I think. So that's why, that's what I was excited about when I came here. And I arrived at the point that we were sliding into recession.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a bit of a depressing period where some of the things that looked like they might have happened around Ark in the town, you know, derelict buildings, where there was just like the potential for them to regenerate, mm-hmm. kind of got stuck on hold a little bit.
Yeah.
But actually, we had a whole load of stuff to sort out here, so that was kind of fine. And then as the towns emerged from that, and, you know, we're by no means out of the recession, but I think people got their act together, and we're very, very lucky here. We have a very well-run, forward-thinking local authority, and they decided to invest to survive and thrive rather than, you know, just sort of manage decline. So the whole town centre has been regenerated. £20 million has been spent on it. They've done lots of work to line up other areas around the town centre. There's lots of new housing developments and things going on. And it feels like we've played our part in that regeneration. Yeah. And as we've kind of grown up and developed who we are and what we do and who we work with, we've kind of been part of that bigger change. So when I arrived, that's kind of what I wanted to see, and it was probably a little bit further off than I hoped.
Yeah.
But that's why I'm still here. I'm, you know, 8 years on, there's still loads to do, but we're starting to reap the benefits of the work that we've done.
Okay. And so it's interesting in that I think you're the first person I've spoken to that's been like, I came and it was a failing organisation. Because that, I think, the transformation from failing to even just survival, but failing to thriving, which is what ARC is phenomenal. I mean, this is a little bit of a detour, but I just, for you, what is, why was it failing? Are you allowed to tell me that? What is a failing organisation?
Okay. I think it was failing on many levels.
Mm-hmm.
Fundamentally, it was failing financially, and, you know, it's, if it's failing financially, it's failing on other levels. So that's the one that everyone focuses on, and that's the kind of the big indicator.
Mm.
So the year before I arrived, it lost something like, the turnover was under £1 million at the time, and it had lost 170,000 in 1 year. So, you know, it was fundamentally failing on many levels for the kind of financial impact to be that bad.
Yeah.
So it soaked up all its reserves. It was, you know, we were left with a kind of unrestricted deficit, which we've eventually cleared. Where it was really failing, I think, is it was very inward looking. I think it's very common to new organisations, new buildings. You get given this lovely shiny new building, you're running around trying to find all the light switches. Your job is to get people into the building, so you sit in the building and you try and get people in. And I'd been through that in Maidenhead, and we'd done exactly the same thing, and then I'd kind of worked out that to get people in the building you had to go out of the building. Which doesn't mean, it's not as obvious as, oh, just do loads of outreach work. It means physically going out of the building and talking to people and inviting them to come in.
And taking them by the hand and pulling them behind you.
Exactly. So ARC had been very inward looking, and it had failed, I think, to really engage in any kind of partnership or collaborative work. It'd forgotten who it didn't really know what it was. So when I came here, I talked to lots of staff, and no one really knew what ARC was. There wasn't a kind of clear vision for it, which sounds really obvious, but as I said at the time, if we don't understand what we are, how on earth do we expect anyone outside the organisation to know what we are? So I think it just, that's how it failed, really. It lost sight of what it was there to do, who it was, who it was for. It wasn't engaging other people, and hence it was a bit of a spiral of decline.
So when you turned up and you opened the Pandora's box of doom, and you realised how bad stuff was, which is always the way it is in any new job. You're like, oh Christ, this is the truth.
I think I'd done that before I got here.
Okay.
I was in a position of knowing what I was coming to.
Okay.
Because I had probed quite a lot beforehand.
Good.
But there certainly was a box of doom. It's fair to say it was already open when I got here.
Yeah, vomiting its contents at you.
Yes.
Okay, so what were your priorities? Because I'm always curious, because it seems like there are different kinds of artistic leaders. There are the ones that are like, we're going to survive today and tomorrow, and eventually the period we're surviving will get longer, but it's about survival in the moment.
Yeah.
And then there are the people who are like, I am shooting for my legacy now. From day one, and I'm just really curious how you approached it, because just in terms of the stresses of that.
situation? I would say it was probably more of the first... If that's a spectrum, I was probably closer to the let's survive today and tomorrow and then next week and then what. So I remember in my first 2 weeks, I wrote a business plan for the first 6 months to get us through to the end of March, actually, slightly more than 6 months. That was like the first thing I did, because I got here and I was like, there's no plan. We've heard that recently. There's no plan, there's no budget, you know, I can't manage without those tools. So it was a very simple, what are we going to do between now and the end of March? Mm-hmm. What is realistic to do? Mm-hmm. You know, where are we going to get our money from and how are we going to not spend it was kind of the... So it was much more of a step-by-step process. And then I kind of often talk about the first 2 or 3 years as being a bit of a sticking plaster, certainly in terms of the artistic programme. Mm. It was a pretty standard art centre programme, a bit of everything, good quality, nothing that's going to kind of set the world alight artistically, but kind of solid programme. Mm-hmm. And I brought that with me. That was kind of the, you know, sort of what I'd learned.
Solid and inoffensive?
Yeah, that's a good word. Solid and offensive. Now we're quite offensive with some of our programming, I like to think. But we needed to do that because we needed to kind of work out what was going to work and what wasn't. And I needed to find out, and I don't think I knew how long this would take. I needed to find out what was needed. Mm. Like, what do people want? What is the... Yeah.
What's the hole in this community that needs to be filled?
Exactly. And it probably took 3 years to work that out. Mm. And that was a process of getting to know the Tees Valley, the kind of sub-region we're in, and the wider region. Sort of understanding the culture. I was completely new here, I'd never been before, so there was a lot of just understanding the culture, people's motivations, people's lives, how they shopped, what they, you know, what they did and didn't see, just a lot of listening really. And you kind of absorb that. It'd be very hard to write down how I did that.
Yeah, because that's my next question, is how did you get people to talk about stuff that you needed to listen to?
You have to sort of live with them, I suppose. So I was quite lucky. I did one of the Common Purpose programmes, and lots of people have used about Common Purpose. But what it did for me is it got me into lots and lots of different organisations around the Tees Valley to meet people in other sectors, and that was really useful. So in both public and private sectors, to just talk to people that live and work in the Tees Valley. Most of them are from the northeast, or certainly have been here years, because people do arrive and tend not to leave. Mm-hmm. And that was actually really useful because it was an opportunity to talk to people that weren't involved in the organisation, actually. Yeah. So how else did I do it?
And what did... So, because one of the things I remember when... I remember starting at Oval House and Rachel, my co-director, saying to me, we've got 6 months before we forget what this looks like from the outside.
Yeah.
So we need to know what we're doing now, make that plan now. What did it look like from the outside to people in this community then?
It looked like an amazing building, but no one really knew what it was for.
Okay.
I think that's the thing. It is an amazing building, and it's what at the time it was one of the newest, one of the smartest, big glass-fronted, typical.
It's amazing. It's like being outside in that bar. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, it really is. But no one really knew what it was for, and by no one I include people that... in the organisation as well as people outside. That's how people saw it. But the really lovely thing, and I used to talk about this a lot, and I've kind of forgotten I've been here so long, is that when I arrived, I was an outsider. And the headline in the local paper was, a woman has been appointed to run it up. Which I kept. Someone actually sent it to me. My appointment was obviously announced before I got here, and the marketing manager here at the time kind of sent it to me in advance. And I was like, I'm getting a feel for this place I'm about to move to. Yeah, woman. But I wasn't outside, I did come. And ARC had had a difficult time. Obviously, it opened, it closed again in the sort of around the year 2000, and then reopened, it sort of done okay, and then obviously got into trouble again. Mm. So I really expected to be met with a, come on then, make it work, you southerner, you know, you can come up here and run our venue for us kind of thing. Yeah. And I didn't get that at all. I just was greeted with it from people that had engaged with it or had some kind of cultural engagement. There was just a real sense of, please make it work for us. Please, we really want it to work. We've built this amazing building and it's empty and we just want it to work. And that was unexpected.
Yeah.
And of course, that's, you know, what North East is famous for now, that kind of welcome and that warmth and that friendliness and that openness. But it really was true. Mm. So I didn't come up against negativity. I just came up against a desire to make it work, which was, you know, a bit of pressure at the time, but that's fine.
Yeah, really. Focuses the mind.
Yeah,
it does. So now, 8 years on...
Mm.
I mean, I'm hoping you're not living day to day anymore.
No, I'm pretty sure you're not.
Do you have a long-term idea of what you want to leave behind you here in this job?
Yeah.
And then I think in a minute I'm going to ask you about that across your lifetime.
Yeah, okay. In this job, yes. I want to leave a really strong organisation of people.
Mm.
It's the people that make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't really matter. In 10, 20, 30 years' time, it doesn't really matter whether the building's still here.
Mm-hmm.
But the organisation needs to be.
Right.
And I've always been very careful to describe ARC as an organisation that works from its building. Because I think what we do is more important than where we do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way, it's a beautiful building and I love it and I'm very much a buildings person,
mm-hmm.
but the way that people consume art and culture is changing and will continue to change. So I never want to get too hooked up with the, we've got to have people in here sitting in seats.
Mm.
And I've also seen how that fails, you know, in where I worked in Maidenhead, that whole inward looking, we've got to get people into the building.
Mm.
Actually, have we? Have we got to get them in? What are we trying to do? We're trying to enable people to, you know, experience culture in whatever way is right for them.
Mm.
So maybe we just need to have a word with ourselves.
Maybe what's right for them isn't this building.
Exactly. Mm. And this building is lots of things to lots of people. And the reason I'm passionate about art centres as against some single art form organisations is that you can be a lot more flexible with how people are experiencing culture.
Mm.
And you can offer lots of different experiences and probably... You know, very few people come and sit in seats in the dark in this building, and certainly not in, you know, rows of seats in the dark. Then we had a whole season where all the theatre in the theatre happened on the stage, so, you know, we might as well have just got rid of the seats. So we can play around with those things a fair amount, but even then we need to recognise that we're still a building, and we're still a building that, for some people, belongs to other people.
Mm-hmm.
So what I hope to leave behind is a cultural organisation that continues to enable lots and lots of different people to experience culture, but that might not necessarily be in the building.
That's interesting, because I think one of the things that I feel like I shout a lot about whenever someone gives me the opportunity to do so is that we, as an ecology, we quite often overlook the value of a human structure in favour of a physical structure, and really physical structures should be built to fall down. Because they're going to.
Yes, they are.
And it's the human structures that will perpetuate any kind of culture or values or ethos.
And I think there's an interesting thing going on at the moment about investing in artists.
Mm.
And we want to invest more in artists. We want to pay artists properly. We're working really hard to try and fulfil that commitment.
Mm.
But I think we're doing that slightly at the detriment of investing in talent development across the whole spectrum of kind of cultural delivery. And I think it's just something, the dialogue going on in my head at the moment around that.
Right, unpick that for me a little bit.
I suppose there's been such a backlash against artists not being paid properly.
Mm.
Absolutely right. I'm fully signed up.
Yes, don't send letters.
No, please don't. As I say, and we are rethinking some of the things that we do to enable us to pay artists better. Even if that maybe means less artists, but we pay them properly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a better way to go than paying everyone, you know, not enough. But we've done so much work around talent development, to use the Arts Council language, around artists.
Mm.
I think we've perhaps been forgetting that we need to invest in people that are going to do my job in the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, lots of people complain about the size of marketing departments and organisations.
Yeah.
But someone has to get the audience. I don't think marketing departments are necessarily the answer.
Mm.
I think that we have to work out whole new ways of engaging with people.
Yeah. And we're not training like whatever marketing is in the future. Yes. We're not training people for now, never mind for the future.
No, we're not.
And actually, organisation to organisation, I spend a lot of time in organisations across the country, and in almost everyone, it's the marketing department that gets kicked or that gets moaned about or that.
Yeah.
And that, I think that's, yeah, you're right. That's something that has to be figured out.
Yeah. And I suppose those challenges are highlighted somewhere like Stockton. Recruitment is one of our biggest challenges, and we're lucky that we have great staff here, and we've worked really hard to get them, and we've worked really hard to grow them, because the cultural infrastructure in Stockton, the Tees Valley, is so tiny. If you want an arts marketing manager, well, there's one in the Tees Valley, and she works here. There's one at BMO, maybe there might be two, but do you know what I mean? It's very, very hard to find people that have the experience. So that lack of investment in developing skills across technicians, again, we have challenges recruiting technicians. We're growing our own, and that needs to be a much bigger part of our work going forwards.
And actually, especially in terms of marketing and audience development, they don't need to be people from here, but it really helps.
Yeah.
Because then they're speaking in the vernacular of the place.
Yeah. And in a way, they should be, because we want to... We want more people to have the opportunity to work in the arts. You know, that feels really important. And you can talk about diversity in all its, in the broader sense, in all these different ways. And we feel we have a really important part to play in diversifying who works in the arts, who gets to perform on our stages, because we're from a different place. You know, we're not from a place that traditionally has produced work or produced people that work in the arts. So.
It's funny, isn't it? Because there is such a proud history of artistic engagement in this region and across the northeast and the northwest generally, all of the industrial revolution towns. Why is it a place that that hasn't produced? I want to say professional, but then I want to kick myself for using that word.
Sure.
But let's use whatever that word means.
Yeah. Because people haven't been valued. Because people don't think they can. Because they haven't been valued. Because they've been measured by other people's standards. Mm. There's a really interesting thing where we're working with some venues across the northeast on a strategic touring project. Mm-hmm. And it's been really interesting to talk to those venues who are doing amazing work in their communities, who are so in touch with their audiences because they meet them and talk to them and listen to them and serve them, and that they, at the beginning of the project, it was really noticeable that people felt like that was a bad thing because they operated in that way, and other organisations, and I'm trying not to name, but more traditional organisations, let's name them like Northern Stage and Line, are seen as the grown-ups, they're seen as the proper theatres. So unless you're behaving like those proper theatres, and art centres suffer in exactly the same way. I think art centres are coming into their prime at the moment, and I think now is the time to be an art centre is one of my favourite phrases, but there is a sense that theatres and galleries, as I say, single art form venues, are proper grown-up venues, and everyone else is a bit of a poor relation. So there hasn't been the value put on those venues.
Because of the status.
Because of the status.
Yeah, those organisations in that mould exist on, the division of audience and artist, and this kind of the stratification of who has the right to curate culture.
Yeah. And the critical acclaim, they are in pursuit of critical acclaim in a way that we're not, actually. We have a different ethos and a different... It's not a criticism. Mm. There is a place for that in the ecology. Mm. But it's just interesting that we're constantly... If we're not careful, we're constantly measuring ourselves against those organisations, which is devaluing other...
Have you... So someone sent me a GIF the other day on Facebook, because I'd been moaning about my, I don't know, massive arse probably. And it was a picture of a rhino running on a treadmill looking at a picture of a unicorn as the inspiration.
Yeah.
And it's just measuring something against something that it isn't.
Yeah.
And actually these spaces are so, art centres are so much more democratic And I feel like that's the thing that, you know, when I'm listening or speaking at a conference and there are big buildings that are worried about diversity and audience engagement, and the answer that you want to club them to death with is your spaces aren't democratic. It isn't a place that people own.
No.
And art really is.
Yeah. And that we're trying to make it a place that, that kind of people own. And every now and again you have one of those conversations that makes you think, oh, we're nearly there.
Mm.
Someone said this, you know, I was talking to someone the other day from one of our classes who was saying how she'd seen someone come for the first time and she'd gone over and said, oh, you know, come join us. This is what we normally do. We normally leave our shoes there and we do this and we order our coffee in advance. Mm. And I was kind of like, that's brilliant, because any one of our staff can do that. But the fact that one of the participants is doing that for someone else kind of shows that she has real ownership over that particular time and place, you know. And that's one of those moments where you go, yeah, that's what we want. We want people like you to own this, and you are doing. And then other days you just want to bang your head against the wall because it's not working. So they're not all like that. But that's it. They have that ownership over that space. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to the question that I posed forever ago now. So you get, you want to leave art with a healthy human structure, in short. So in, you know, 100 years, when Annabel Turpin is no more, and we are writing the history of British culture, what do you want your lifetime legacy to have been?
Ooh. How hilarious to even imagine that. And that's quite funny.
I mean let's imagine that it's a really exhausting.
Yes.
You know, we're all in it. Everyone's in it.
That's more comfortable. I'm certainly more comfortable than that. There's so much and so little in some ways. I want to have changed something.
Mm.
Maybe it's, I mean, I haven't done it yet. So this I might be future looking in terms of what I've got left to do.
It's totally cool.
It is about that democracy, I think. I want to have really made inroads into challenging those structures that prevent that more democratic view.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to challenge how we measure things and the value. I think value is something that's really uppermost. So I suppose I'd like people to look back and see the work that we do at ARC, and perhaps as we start to stretch out and do different things and influence maybe how other people behave, that we've somehow challenged that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a very concrete answer, is it?
No, but I think that's probably all right.
Is it?
Yeah, you want to leave the world changed.
Yeah.
I'm going to make an assumption for the better rather than for the worse.
Yeah, yes, definitely. I mean, it is. It's about more people being able to make a choice to have culture as part of their lives. You know, that sounds very grand, but and I'm using culture
because everyone has culture.
Yeah,
telly is culture.
It is.
Pop music is culture.
It is.
Sorry,
I sort of mean that in a way because I think if we talk about, as soon as we say theatre, then what people imagine is people sat in seats in the dark watching a show that has two acts and an interval, in their smart clothes, you know, that isn't the kind of theatre I'm talking about. If I said theatre and I thought that you were immediately imagining that massive outdoor street art show that took place in Stockton Town Centre last year that, you know, 2,000 people watched, then I'd probably use the word theatre.
Okay.
But because I'm very aware that as soon as you say theatre, people think of a certain thing, and they definitely don't think about the work that happens in art centres.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be in a theatre with a curtain. I'm avoiding using the word theatre.
Okay.
I suppose I mean, and I do mean it in the broadest sense. I do want people to have access to pop music and TV, and, you know, they're rich sources of
good TV.
Good TV
changes the world. Really
it really does. So we shouldn't. Yeah, we shouldn't be snobby about that, I don't think. Mm.
Good. Okay. Leave the world changed.
Yeah, but it's very vague.
I mean, you can be more specific if you want. It's entirely your call, but you don't have to be.
No.
I'm not evaluating this on points.
I suppose it's something like, I should have thought this out before, a more democratic consumption of culture.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's quite a big thing for us, is just enabling anyone and everyone to have that choice.
can I change a word in that?
Yes.
I mean, obviously, this is your legacy that I'm now
tinkering. No, help. I need all the help I can get.
Because I recently I've been struggling with the word consumption because I'm sick of being a consumer. Yeah. So maybe there's something about democratic interaction or
experience. Yeah.
Or play.
I want culture to be experienced more democratically. Enjoyed.
Enjoyed. So
I want a more democratic enjoyment of culture.
Okay, that's a legacy. That's a great legacy. Yeah.
Yeah. And that ties into some of the things we're doing. You know, the whole pay what you decide, the way that we're working with local groups and things. It is about trying to enable anyone to be able to make that choice.
Yeah. Okay, so
not everyone, anyone. I don't think we should be hitting people over the head saying you must enjoy
because I think that makes people not want to come as soon as you should do something.
Of course. Well, we do that all the time.
Like, I quite liked broccoli until someone told me I should eat it, and now
So it's anyone, not everyone.
That's a really important distinction that I hadn't thought about. Okay, so you mentioned pay what you can, and that I feel like that's been one of your massive, like, activist successes.
Yeah,
the past couple of years. Do you tell me a bit about that?
We'd been doing a lot of talking about pricing and been trying to think of different ways of pricing things to make it more accessible. We felt too charitable, I think, you know, bestowing offers and discounts and free tickets on people that risked devaluing things and risked being quite patronising. We've been playing around with the idea of asking people to pay afterwards because we're like, well, you pay for a meal after you've had it, pay for your haircut after you've had it, you know, but we are insistent on people paying in advance.
They might not come.
Well, but, you know, it just felt odd with kind of behaviour. So we looked at what Slunglow were doing, and I'm always very clear to credit Slunglow. It was pay what you decide was not my idea.
I'm poor, my badass.
We borrowed it from them, with their blessing, hopefully. And we were going to try it for a week. And it was all quite last minute. We'd booked the whole of the spring season, and this was kind of November. And we were trying to find a week where we could do everything on a pay-what-you-decide basis. And every week we looked at had some event in it. It was like, oh, the promoter won't swallow that. Or, you know, well, actually, that one's already on sale. And then I was like, hang on a second. This is about removing the risk of going to see things that you're not sure about. So why would we do pay-what-you-decide on Mark Watson? Or, Jason Cook or a band that people have been listening to at home for years. It just doesn't make sense. Where we really want to employ this...
It's the stuff where they don't know.
It's the stuff where they don't know, because that's what we're responding to. We'd ask people why they didn't come, and they said, because we don't know the people in it.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. So lots of the work we've done had obviously been about trying to introduce artists and companies before we were asking people to make that commitment. So I was like, let's just do it on the theatre programme. Let's do it on the whole theatre programme. And I'd got a very up-for-it marketing manager at the time, and she was like, okay, let's do it. So we just did it on the entire theatre programme for 6 months. And we're very honest in saying, this is a trial. If it fails, we'll tell you.
Don't get excited.
Yeah. And we were kind of... We would try rather... I don't know, maybe this is a bit arrogant, but we were trying to assume a position of, look, everyone's really interested in how this is working, but a bit scared, so we're going to try it on behalf of everyone else. So if it doesn't work, you'll all be really grateful that we've tried
it. We'll take one for the team. But you're all going to send us 10 quid to our crowdfunder, okay?
Exactly. We might need to bail out the other end. It was a very measured risk, actually, and I won't go into all the ways that it was, but it was a very measured risk. I never thought it would be as successful as it has been. It has been phenomenally successful for us.
So tell the, our listener
some of the stats. Oh, I've come with the stats.
Come on, you've got to have them in your head.
Audiences are way up. I was trying to quote them last week. Audiences are way up, income's up, average ticket yield's up. But the kind of, the most exciting thing actually is not the stats, it's the people that are coming. And there is something beautifully democratic, that's going to be the word of the day, when you sit in the audience and you see people coming in that, quite honestly, we would have given free tickets to, or we would have given discounts to get them through the door, but we don't have to anymore. They can come on their own terms. Mm. So the very first night that we ran it, a group of about 10 people came in and sat down. And during the show, I became aware that most of them were learning disabled.
Mm.
And I was like, that's amazing. They've just come. I don't know who they are.
This is not an organised group.
No, exactly. What's happened? And it turns out they're part of a social group. Mm. And because the organiser would see Poet You Decide, she'd kind of gone, oh, that enables me to make it affordable for them.
Mm.
So she talked to them all, and they'd all agreed they'd put £5 in each, which they duly did at the end, which, you know, she sorted out. Now, if she'd come to us, of course we'd have said, you can have £5 tickets, because we're really keen to reach out to that audience.
Yeah.
But the fact we didn't have to, the fact they could just come on their own terms, is amazing.
Because, again, it changes that power structure.
Of course it does.
Because it puts the audience, the person in the situation of power where they are choosing to be here. They're not being cajoled or coerced or patronised or bullied.
And they're not being told they should be here.
Mm.
That's the other thing.
Yeah.
It goes back to that thing of, it's not good for you. It's something you might enjoy coming to.
Yeah.
And we'd like to invite you to come.
We love it. It's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing, that it is a great message to send out, that you've never heard of these people and you've never heard of this show, but we are so confident that you're going to enjoy it that we're not going to ask you to pay till afterwards. And if you don't like it, you don't have to pay.
Mm.
And there's kind of a confidence to that. People go, oh, right. Well, it must be good then.
Yeah.
You know?
What's the worst that can happen?
So I am a Pay What You Decide ball. I absolutely love it. It has been amazing for us.
Mm.
It's not a model for everyone, and I think it's really important to be clear about that.
Mm.
It's an audience development tool. It is about diversifying your audiences, but it's particularly appropriate for getting people into new work.
Mm.
It is for unfamiliar work. If you're doing something that is really familiar to people, then it's probably not the right model, because people are going to come anyway.
If they're going to pay 40 quid, let them pay 40 quid.
Yeah, although different people might come if you can pay what you decide. But that's for you and your conscience to work out who you want to come to.
I'll add it to
shows,
the list of things my conscience has to worry about.
But do you know what I mean? Different people will
come.
I was talking to some theatres the other day, and it's interesting to hear how some people are just going, wow, yes, that's very successful, and how much more money did you make? And other theatres were kind of, and these were American theatres originally, and other theatres were saying, we're really desperate to get people in from our local community.
Mm.
You know, we want to use this as a way of reaching out to those people, of making it accessible to them, but in what is quite a non-patronising way.
Mm.
In fact, quite the opposite. You're saying, I value your opinion. I'm trusting you to make your own judgment about this.
Yeah.
I'm not telling you what it's worth to you. That's for you to decide. And there's some kind of respect there. It's all subliminal, but
and there's
I really
a reciprocity
believe it.
To it as well.
Yeah.
In that I trust you to be fair in how you value this, and you trust me to be honest in how I present it, and that I value it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really.
It's a beautiful model. I mean, I wish I could claim credit for it, really, because it is a beautiful model.
Yeah.
And as I say, for the right things in the right places, it's amazing.
Mm-hmm. So,
so there's a little bit of legacy there, maybe.
That's a big step towards democratising enjoyment of culture,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What was my question? My question was, do you... So it's probably two linked questions, in that I think I do what I do because I want to change the world, and I want and I am probably a complete narcissist, and I believe that if I can just talk to enough people, they'll believe me about stuff.
Yeah.
Do you think the arts, theatre and the arts, can change the world?
Oh, yes. Of course.
Good. Tell me how, because some people don't.
Okay. By helping people see the world through different eyes, to understand how other people think and feel, and it's about empathy, I suppose. The kind of bottom line is, if you're only one person, you're only looking at the world through one set of eyes, through one set of circumstances, whereas any kind of cultural experience pretty much presents you with a perspective from someone else.
Mm.
So always used to have this argument with my partner about reading. So I read a lot, and I read fiction. I can't bear non-fiction. He reads non-fiction all the time.
Yeah.
And he's like, but it's all made up. And I was going, but I learn so much from it. Just because it's made up doesn't mean that you don't learn from it.
And also, just to be a pretentious wanker for a moment, everything about how we understand the world is made up. It's just what we decide to is the logical thing. Yeah.
Exactly.
Every story we tell about ourselves is a story. Sorry.
You read boring stories, I read interesting ones. That's fine. Yeah, I read enjoyable ones.
Yeah.
So for me, that's how it can change the world, because it can make people see the world from someone else's perspective, and it can help them understand how other people think and feel. And is that enough? I think that's how we can change the world.
I think that, and I think also art. I worry about that word, but let's use it.
I use the word culture, but art's
It was because my dad is an artist, and he is a potter, and he would never describe himself as an artist because that's like othering himself. Yeah. He makes stuff. So I have somehow a distrust of that. But anyway, I'll get over it. I feel like art really immediately alleviates the fucking awfulness of being human. Or even if it's not being fucking awful being a human just now, it makes it nicer.
Yeah.
Like it really, like, it, like, immediately transforms the experience of existing in the world.
Yeah.
Quite quickly. And then you think, and then you can go out and transform other people's existence because you are empathetic with them.
Yeah. Well, so, there is a beauty to it. Like, whatever you create, and even the show, you know, a performance about the ugliest of things to the most beautiful piece of visual art. Like, there is a beauty to that, isn't there? There has to be.
Yeah.
That's what we do it for.
Yeah.
We're trying to present something that has some form of beauty.
Yeah. And there's a beauty to the act of understanding and unpicking. Because I think that maybe that's why culture is so special just now, because we don't like to acknowledge the value of intricacy and complexity. Yeah. And what art does is it gives you this thing, and it looks beautiful and simple and easy, but the act of it existing is so intricate.
It is. There's a lot about understanding, I think, about developing that understanding for others, in all the senses of other and others. I don't know what else we'd do. I mean, we're going to change the world. Like, I don't have any other means to change the world.
Yeah. So the thing that I mean, you know, people quite often, you work in the arts. You've had people. I'm sure you've had people saying, you know, get a proper job or whatever.
Yeah.
And just recently, I've been thinking a lot about what my answer to that is. Because I gave up a salary job recently,
and now
I have to justify what I'm doing every day in a way I didn't before. And I think this isn't really about me, but let's screw it, I'm a narcissist. I think everything we are as human beings exists and is defined by the stories we tell as human beings. Why would you not want to be a storyteller?
Yeah.
That's the most powerful position in a society, is the person that spins the fabric of the society. I'm just sort of rephrasing.
That's a lovely answer, actually. That's a really nice answer.
Because you can, like, you really are changing the world. You just go, okay, I'm gonna weave this bit differently.
Yeah. Why
would you not want to do that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a nice answer. I'll remember that one.
Thanks. You can take that.
Yeah.
I'll have forgotten it by next week. And I'll just rage at people. I'll be like, because it's important. Leave me alone. I'm not sure how long I've been talking for. Probably a while. Tell me what's... what's next for you, for ARC,
Well, I think I've still got quite a lot to do here. And as anyone who's been in the same job for 8 years probably knows, you go through periods of thinking, I've got to get out. I've got to leave. I've been here this long. But I think one of the things that I've really learned and am really enjoying is that sense of what you can achieve through longevity. And there's things that I already have done and hopefully will continue and go on to do that I couldn't do if I'd only been here 3 years.
Yeah.
And it is about that people thing. So I've built what I hope is a really strong organisation of people, and I'm not just talking about people that work at ARC, but people across the country, across the world, may I say, even with some of the newest contacts. But do you know what I mean? People that I'm in touch with that in some way, shape or form either affect what I do here or perhaps in some tiny way might affect what they do there. So that network of people and contacts and relationships and trust enables you to do things that as soon as you move, you're kind of back to square one, or maybe square two, because you take a little bit with you.
And you have to renegotiate it.
And re-establish yourself. And as I say, it took me 3 years at least to understand like what the gap was here. So it's like having understood that and just started to kind of work on it, it's a long-term game. So I think there is still plenty here to do. And I'm interested in that change in the way that people enjoy culture. I want to be part of that. I don't want to be stuck in a building going, oh my God, people are seeing it on the streets, we've got to get them into seats. I want to be part of that and I want to drive that, which potentially means I've got to drive change as a building-based organisation. And that's a really exciting challenge. One day we might lock the doors. I mean, how amazing would that be to, you know, I'm sure that's many decades off, but there might come a time where we go, do you know what, it's actually right for us to move out of an organisation. And in a way, I think it'd be more interesting to do that from within an organisation than just wait till you have to move and go to a non-building based organisation. Do you know what I mean? I think I'm quite interested in overseeing that change. I'm not saying I'm going to be here for like 30 years or whatever, but so part of what we're just thinking about in the more sort of medium term, I suppose, kind of next 10 to 15 years, is what our delivery looks like. You know, what do we deliver here and what do we deliver elsewhere? And how do those two have a relationship?
And I feel like the future is in the public square.
It's got to be. It's got to be.
In some way or another.
Yeah. So if we're delivering more out there being in every way, shape or form, digitally, real life, all the rest of it, what do we use the building for? Is this where we make it? Do we make more here? People need spaces to make things in.
I feel like spaces to make things is really valuable. There's much less of it than you think. And I think
but it's also about anyone making it. It's about enabling anyone to make.
Which it which again is why Slanglow is so brilliant, because you can just rock up and use their stuff. Without sitting a test. So maybe there's something about just the access, the permeability of the building. The porousness. I'm stealing that word from Rachel Briscoe because she talks about it a lot.
But it's a great word.
And
the value we then put on the work that those people make. We've got to see it through. I think there's a danger we kind of go, come in and make all your stuff. That's lovely, we'll let anyone make. And then we go, but this is the proper theatre. So we have to really challenge the value that we put on things.
So, I entirely and completely agree with you while simultaneously worrying about that. Because I think that we absolutely have to make permeable the line between professional and participatory. Let's not worry about this word just now. And I think I'm really into, especially the movements around like fun palaces, the sense of everyone an artist and artistic practice and just art being a thing that a human being is what you do.
Yeah.
we should call more things art
yes.
than we do, right? It doesn't have to happen in a special place. So this is all yeah. true. Let's put yeah. it in a big true pile. And then over here, I want to look at the stuff that is so beyond an ordinary person's technical reach,
yep.
that is sublime and that is elevating and that yep. is wonderful.
Yep.
And I want both of those things to exist.
Yep.
And I want access for, what was it, the democratisation of enjoyment of culture yep. to go right across yep. those things. But I think we're just right now, we're not very good at holding both those things to be true. And that sublime genius, yep. that, you know, that spark,
yep.
that is wonderful mm-hmm. and as valuable as, yep. as anybody's spark, yep. actually, as a slightly yep. less genius spark,
yeah, yeah.
just a spark. So I don't know how to talk about those things in the yeah. same world.
Well,
help me.
I suppose first of all, I'd say I want more of those people to be able to do that.
Right. So we're pointing at yeah. we're pointing at the everyone an artist pile. Do yeah. we want more of those people to be able yeah. to be sublime?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we need to do more to enable that process. Mm-hmm. So it's not a static thing.
Yeah.
You know, there are opportunities. I don't know what the answer is, but I completely accept that challenge of how we make sense of both of those things. Mm. We don't do it in the arts, we can't do it in the arts, we wrestle with it all the time, but sport does it brilliantly.
Yeah.
So somehow we've got to look at how sport does it and go, why can't we do that in the arts?
Yeah, and you know, it's really interesting because you have to be amateur to compete in the Olympics.
Yeah.
Like
yeah, which is always a bit of a
Olympic. Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
yeah. I think when you look at sport, they're so good at supporting the people that are really talented and really mm. exceptional and have something that element of genius in a sporting mm. sense. But at the same time, they gather up everyone else and go,
yeah.
but everyone can play sport.
Yeah.
Come and kick a ball around on a Sunday morning. And you can take it at any level of seriousness. Like, we could go and kick a ball around down there now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I feel like that would be really funny.
I think it would be really yeah. fun. And that would be fine.
Yeah.
And then...
And it would know. Still be... We would still be playing football, or whatever.
Yeah.
Ball we were kicking.
Exactly.
Rugby.
And no one would think that was odd. Well, they might think
yeah.
Yeah, maybe they would. But do you know what I mean? Yeah. Sport does it really well. It manages yeah. to support the kind of that horrible gifted and talented phrase. They manage to support gifted and talented, and yet sport is so inclusive.
Yeah,
people may argue with that, but I think it is more inclusive.
Yeah, why?
I don't know. I'm trying to work it
because,
out.
Because think about how, like, thinking about me as a kid and my experience as a kid in Wolverhampton, mm-hmm. in a town not too dissimilar from Stockton,
yeah.
And everybody, every kid I knew, every girl I knew, and some of the boys,
yeah.
Did dancing or singing or gymnastics, or I'm counting gymnastics as like
yeah,
a bit of
yeah,
a dancey
yeah.
thing, or played instruments, or did like painted mm-hmm. or drew, or like there was a massive democratic and pervasive mm, practice of art, and that was true.
Mm-hmm.
But then lots of other things were true as well. Like, I was the only person in my. There were a lot of people way more interested in art and talented mm-hmm. at art than mm-hmm. I was in my school class.
Yeah.
I was the only person that was allowed to pursue it like it might be my career.
Interesting.
And one of my friends, because my dad's an artist, and one of the things he did was teach design. And he ran a come and design shit night
yeah.
for the parents of my school. And one of the parents, while I was round this particular girl's house, he sold cars. And he said, I'm not going to go and spend my afternoon playing with cards. I'm a grown man. Grown men don't play with card and scissors. And that was really interesting because those cars that he was selling were created through that design process, through a design process. So all of that moshed up, and I think there's something about capitalism.
Yeah.
Because there are, I think there are probably more really well-paid sports people.
Yes.
Or even just averagely paid sports people than there are averagely paid artists. Like, I feel like the vast majority of artists are below average.
Yeah.
On the income scale. And so there's something about how we, because we live, for better or worse, in a capitalist market economy, value equals money. So maybe in order to be more inclusive as an industry, we have to make it there has to be a valuable payback to your time. Because I'm just going to put my Marxist hat on, because we're all cogs in the uber capitalist machine, and we must be the best cog we can be to run that machine, and because art isn't an efficient output, let's not build those cogs. And all of that isn't necessarily conscious.
But is sport, so do we value sport because it makes us healthy, but watching sport doesn't make us
healthy? We don't value sport because it makes us healthy. That's bollocks. We value sport because it makes the adrenaline pound, either when you're playing it or when you're watching it. It's about like competition and tribalism, and like I feel like that's way back to hunter-gatherer brain. It's chasing down the mammoth.
But is it because we place that value on it that it manages to do what we were talking about, that it manages to support the really talented but also include people at any level as watchers or take parters?
Because so this is interesting because we're talking, because there are two ways to talk about it, aren't there? There's the way that sport as an industry, as an ecology, is better at engaging these people, and that the theatre is not so good, or the arts are not so good at engaging these people. But actually, there's a, maybe we're looking at it the wrong way. Maybe it isn't about small miniature ecologies within the wider machine being better. Maybe it's about enabling the people at the bottom, like in the, you know, this grassroots thing, to get involved. Because as soon as it's top down, it's like, you should be doing this. We're back to should,
which is bad.
Yeah, and that's where art comes from. Like, I've never heard, I'm sure this happens all the time, and I'm being a dick, right? But it's rare to hear someone go, "Oh, you'll really enjoy that."
Yeah,
go on.
Well, it's interesting because I was challenging that yesterday talking to a company when they were talking about how much fun their show was. And I said, and does that come across in your marketing materials?
Do you say it's funny?
Yeah, because actually people don't like saying it's funny because they're scared, you know, they're setting expectations or it's not worthy. So I think we fundamentally forget to say that experiencing culture is fun.
Yeah, because you don't ever see, like, marketing copy or stuff to bring people in that goes, this is really funny or scary, it's going to make you cry, it's going to make you feel stuff. We don't say that.
We don't say that at all.
We talk about the brain stuff.
We don't feel.
I mean, we do. I've been feeling a lot since that bloody referendum, I'll tell you.
I'm sure, but we pretend we don't.
We pretend we don't. But other, you know, the Americans don't necessarily do it either. And they feel all over the place.
Yeah. So I think part of the reason for that, and this is something that we've been thinking about quite a lot recently, is the particular part of the cultural sector that we work in is subsidised. And there is a psychological a kind of responsibility to justify the subsidy.
It has to be valuable to the nation. Yeah.
So I can't say, come watch this show, it's brilliant, you're going to have such fun. I have to say, come watch this show, it's really good, it will do this, that and the other for you. Or for the world.
But we can, it's just about who you're talking to.
Of course.
We're just rubbish at it.
We're just really fundamentally bad at it. We are.
So it is our fault, right?
Constantly trying to talk about how good it is in a craft sense. You know, it's exquisite.
Like, I don't care how well that banana cake is sliced. No. I don't care. I don't care how well it's baked. I want it to be delicious.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the bit that we want to know. Yeah. We want to feel.
Yeah.
And we just talk about it badly. And that goes all the way back to when we were talking earlier about We're not investing in developing people that can sell this stuff.
Mm.
And I'm not talking about marketing departments. I've said marketing is probably something completely different.
Yeah.
We're not investing in that, and we need to, because we're not getting it right.
No. But it has to be everybody.
Yeah.
Like every single person.
I know.
Has to know how to do that.
Yeah, that's going to be my legacy.
Okay.
I'm going to change the way that people sell culture.
Can we not use sell?
Okay, yes, that's a bad word.
Just because I've got my Marxist hat on still.
Yeah.
Like,
Invite. I love the word invite. We talk about inviting audiences a lot.
Share,
yeah, that's nice.
Change the way people share culture.
Yeah. But it is about how we talk about it and how we present it to people, how we invite people in to share it.
Yeah. I don't feel particularly invited to sport.
Do you not?
No. Like, I am to sport. You know, there's that fable of, like, someone coming along to the RSC in their jeans and T-shirts and broad accent and being tutted at?
Yeah.
I am that to sport.
How interesting.
I turn up in my wrong clothes and wrong shoes and I give up after 3 metres.
To play or to watch?
Certainly to play.
Yeah.
And I don't understand I don't really understand watching.
Mm.
Or to do it.
That's interesting.
I don't always understand watching theatre either.
No, it's
I want to do it. Or, you know, the things that I enjoy about, I don't really enjoy watching sport, but they're mostly aesthetic, like the shorts on rugby players, you know, it's not. I just can't.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I watch a lot of sport, which usually surprises people.
Yeah.
And I would say I got into watching sport from enjoying the collective experience, the shared experience.
Ah, okay.
So didn't really know anything about what was going on the pitch, didn't know the rules, but just enjoyed that collective experience, which is not something you would expect someone that likes theatre to.
Okay, so right. So for example, I had a friend who took me to Wimbledon, and I really enjoyed drinking Pimm's and like chatting and trying to understand what was happening. That was good.
Yeah. So that's how I got into sport, is I went to some live football matches and went, this is amazing. 30,000-40,000 people all doing the same thing, all standing up at the same time. Literally, this is my experience of watching football when I first started. All sitting down at the same time. This is amazing, you know.
Who gives the signal? How do they know?
It's kind of those sort of questions. One of my favourite moments is a minute's silence, which obviously is very sad for the person that we're commemorating, but
we all
standing
do it together.
In a stadium of, you know, tens of thousands of people, I think the biggest I've been in had about 90,000 people. I was thinking, please let there be a minute's silence, which is really awful, obviously, but because there is something amazing about being in a group of people that big when everyone observes it. It's one of the most magical things ever. So that's how I got into sport. Obviously, I've then developed an appreciation of, you know, a number of different sports and like watching them and understand the craft of them and the skill. But that's where it started. So when you trace that path, you kind of go, oh yeah, it's like sitting in a theatre. It's like those magic moments when the lights go down or, you know, someone starts something and you get that kind of feel.
A collective experience.
Yeah.
I feel like I have to stop asking questions now. Thank you so much for talking to me.
It's been great.
It's been really interesting. I don't think we actually talked about legacy that much, but it was interesting. It doesn't matter.
Okay.
It doesn't matter. It was interesting, and that's what I care about.
And it's dinner time.
Yes.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.